Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dr. Walter Dean, and you're on the show called Getting It Done. I don't know if we're going to really have an opportunity to really get it done today, but we're going to do the best we can. Today's show is being broadcasted in Connecticut. This weekend in Waterbury, Connecticut, and this weekend, a good friend, a fraternity brother, a former Army officer, and a school teacher from my hometown, Waterbury, passed away. He was one of the people that, when I first started teaching school, took me under his wing and protected me my first year of teaching. Showed me all the ropes and explained to me things I should do and things I should not do. Actually, it was laid down a fantastic foundation for me. I never really paid that much attention except when seeing him in his Army uniform as a lieutenant when I was growing up. I didn't have that much knowledge about him. I didn't know that he even went to college, but he was extremely knowledgeable about education and cared a lot about children. Worked hard with those children early in the morning. You know, I'd get to school, he'd be there at Slocum working with children. When I would leave, he'd still have some kids after school working with them and helping them with math. He was a fantastic math teacher. But he taught, I think it was fourth or fifth grade. We will miss him, and I will be here to speak about him as much as I possibly can. His name was Harold Pettaway. Harold Pettaway is a man to be respected and a person that I really and truly enjoyed being around. Always intelligent, always has something positive to say. Therefore, this show is being dedicated to him and, of course, another icon of mine, John Lewis, who was the driving force behind the sit-down strikes that took place throughout the country by college students. I remember him well. I lived during that particular time when a lot of this was going on. Of course, I didn't know him personally, but I knew of him and I saw him. And I really, when he was getting beat up, I remember it happening. It wasn't a situation where I read about it. I was there when it was going on. So this show is being dedicated to he and my good friend, Harold. And it's extremely interesting. So today's show has a number of phases. We are first going to enter into a period for the period that we most need to pay close attention to, 99 days more or less before the election for the presidency of the United States. Our present president will surely replace one of these people that we're going to be listing about today, because this show is about the 10 worst presidents, at least the first half, is about the 10 worst presidents that we've ever had. And I'm quite sure this particular president we have today will fall in line with one of these people. When you listen, you will hear segments of everything this particular president has tried to do. Let's give a listen.
Hi, Mr. Veep, and President's Day is over, so no longer are we going to be praising past presidents, but we are going to be talking trash about past presidents. Somebody send Obama some white hats on how to be a good president. Ha ha. Like I said, that would help. LOL. Here is my video, counting down the 10 worst presidents in American history. According to my opinion, which is just my opinion, I'm a little biased, we all are, so keep that in mind. I'm also aware that this may reveal some of my political beliefs, and that's fine. But without further ado, let's just jump right into it, as Frank Franco says. Number 10, Benjamin Harrison. Okay, he's all about really high tariffs, and you all know how I feel about tariffs, right? Right, I'm not a very big fan of tariffs. Bad job, Benjamin. Harrison was supportive of the overthrow of Queen Liliuokalani and the taking of Hawaii, which is one of the shadiest parts of American history. Also, the Wounded Knee Massacre occurred under his watch. Okay, not only was Harrison approved, but the Army gave out medals of honor like they were candy afterward for a massacre. Number 9, Andrew Johnson. Now, I wasn't going to put him on this list. I feel like a lot of historians talk a lot of trash about him unfairly, but, you know, I'm all about character, right? And this guy was driven by his ego. This guy cared first and foremost only about his own legacy and his own desires. He refused to compromise, and he seemed to dig in his heels when he faced opposition. Speaking of opposition, just as blatant opposition to civil rights for African Americans, so seen with his fighting the 14th and 15th Amendments and Civil Rights Acts. I mean, that ended up holding back African Americans for generations. This makes him look exceptionally bad. And he's a white supremacist, but mostly of his stubbornness in politics. I mean, I know the radical Republicans that he opposed were also stubborn, but his refusal to compromise with them just made it look like he only cared about his own selfish desires and didn't care about the greater good of the country. Number 8, George W. Bush. Okay, obviously I'm even more biased living through the presidency of George W. Bush, but I disagree with his response to the 9/11 attacks in several ways. The AUMF, or the Operation to Use Military Force Against Terrorists, basically did a blank check for the president to fight terrorism around the world. It's still in effect. The Patriot Act, which really was one of the worst laws that were passed in American history, really just stripped many civil liberties that Americans used to take for granted. The Iraq War, dragging out the Afghanistan War with no end in sight. Not a fan of all these things. His response to Hurricane Katrina. The Great Recession happened under his watch, and he responded to it with crony capitalism, which I'm not a big fan of. Bailing out banks and corporations, etc. No child left behind. No teacher I know actually is a fan of No Child Left Behind. Not a good law. He expanded the surveillance states. The Department of Homeland Security, the TSA, all that. Detaining suspects without warrants who were never charged with any crime, never given any due process, just showed that he often made decisions out of fear, not out of reason. But such a nice guy, though. I love you, W. Sorry about this, if you're watching. Number 7, Woodrow Wilson. First of all, Pfeiffer from The Cynical Historian has definitely influenced my perception of Woodrow Wilson.
Wilson!
So a shout-out to him. Go watch his 2 videos where he just completely bashes him. Wilson was all about spreading democracy around the world, a very egocentric foreign policy. Sure, it said, hey, it's self-determination, right? But it assumed that Americans knew what was best for the entire world, and thus Wilson paved the way for future American interventionism. One big reason why he got elected in 1916 was because he said he kept the country out of World War I. What happens after he gets reelected? He gets the country involved in World War I, asking Congress to declare war, and they do. And during the war, the Espionage Act, the Sedition Act, 2 of the worst laws in American history, urinating on the First Amendment. And Cypher pointed this out in one of his videos. I never knew this, but apparently he wanted the Sedition Act before the United States even entered World War I. And most of our presidents were racist, okay? We've got to consider historical relativism, but Wilson was exceptionally racist, even for his time. The screening of The Birth of a Nation at the White House and then calling it historically accurate, not a very smart move by Wilson. Ignoring all the lynchings that were going on across the country when he was president, he ignored a lot of things, apparently, ignoring women's rights. You know, they were marching across the country for the right to vote, he ignored them. He ignored the first Red Scare going on, a lot of chaos around the country, didn't do anything about it. Number 6, William McKinley. This one may surprise many of you because McKinley is consistently ranked in the top half of presidents, usually because the economy was good with U.S. presidents and the U.S. was becoming a world superpower due to a more aggressive foreign policy. Well, guess what? This foreign policy sucks. McKinley's foreign policy was based on a Christian/American exceptionalism mentality that meant the U.S. was going to be spreading its influence around the world in places it shouldn't be. The Spanish-American War. And war dead time wise, McKinley, struggled with the decision at first, but after talking to God, God said, yes, you should go to war with Spain, and so he went to Congress after that, and they declared war on Spain. The Philippine-American War that happened as a continuation of the Spanish-American War, that doesn't get much attention, because it makes the United States look pretty bad, but McKinley justified that war, a war in which Americans killed civilians and rounded them up and put them into concentration camps. McKinley justified this because he thought the Filipinos were incapable of self-governing. He was the first to bypass Congress to send troops to fight in China during the Boxer Rebellion. As I said earlier, yes, the economy was doing well under McKinley's watch, but he had high tariffs. And again, I am not a fan of high tariffs. But mostly I'm a critic of McKinley due to his brash imperialism and his general disregard for the sovereignty of nations that just wanted to be left alone. Number 5, Richard Nixon. He was a pathological liar who mostly just cared about himself and his own legacy, not the general welfare of the country. Boy, did that backfire. I know there are a lot of obvious reasons to hate on Nixon. He was a crook. I mean, Watergate. His paranoia and backstabbing make it seem obvious why he's on this list and most people's lists. However, the war on drugs is probably the biggest mistake of Nixon. Nixon started the war on drugs, and we are still seeing the horrible effects of it. So that's why that tops my list of problems with Nixon. Nixon got elected promising to end the Vietnam War, but the war just dragged on during his presidency. Meanwhile, while secretly dropping bombs and cancer-causing chemicals on civilians in both Vietnam and Cambodia, he implemented wage and price controls, and this was horrible for the economy. A big reason why the horrible stagflation of the 70s occurred was because of his administration. Now, don't get me wrong, Nixon did a lot of good and was highly intelligent. Opening up relations with China, his policy of détente with the Soviet Union, and the creation of the EPA are probably my favorite three accomplishments of Nixon, but he had such poor character. And better stick move. Number 4, Herbert Hoover. Herbert Hoover, of course, makes many lists because of the Great Depression. It's actually a myth that Herbert Hoover did nothing in response to the early stages in what would become known as the Great Depression. The Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, for example, in 1929, raising import taxes, increasing income taxes to balance the budget, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation to bail out businesses, and increased crony capitalism likely just made things worse. Under his watch, a recession became the Great Depression. His treatment of the World War I Dulles Army veterans in D.C. was disgraceful. Simply put, Hoover did try to end the Great Depression, but simply made it worse. FDR didn't have much success either after that, but at least FDR seemed to be more in touch with ordinary people. Hoover seemed very out of touch with most Americans. Number 3, Franklin Pierce. Oh, Pierce, where do I begin? I know, how about with the Kansas-Nebraska Act? Again, a law that was one of the worst laws passed in American history, and he signed it into law. A dope face. Sorry, that was a little harsh there, but, a northerner who was perfectly fine with slavery. The Austin Manifesto. Pierce seemed to be okay with declaring war on Spain if it refused to sell Cuba to the United States. Pierce wanted Cuba annexed as a slave state. Boy, did that make northerners happy. At a rocky time when the country needed unity, Pierce arguably helped further divide the country. Also, at a time when the country needed a more hands-on and active president, he was not. But you know who was worse? Number 2, James Buchanan. That's right, Buchanan was worse. He took over as president after Pierce, and instead of learning from Pierce's mistakes, he just let the country become even more divided. Another face. You didn't have to bleep that out. I said okay, don't face. He was a president who did nothing. He didn't want to make anyone mad, but he also didn't want to make anyone happy. He was personally against slavery. He said it was morally wrong, and yet proceeded to speak out in favor for the Dred Scott decision, one of the worst Supreme Court decisions in American history. In fact, he was so pro-South that he basically just let the South do whatever they wanted. When the state seceded after the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860, he blamed the Northerners and the abolitionists. By the time he was out of office, the United States was on the brink of civil war, and the Union had fallen apart, and he did absolutely nothing to stop it. And the worst president in American history, in my opinion, is Warren Harding. He once said, folks, I am not fit for this office and should never have been here. I agree. He appointed many of his corrupt buddies to be in his cabinet. Some of them famously got in trouble for bribery in what became known as the Teapot Dome Scandal. I know this sounds bad, but it was probably our dumbest president. He was not a deep thinker at all. He seemed to just let all of his corrupt buddies make all the decisions. He didn't stand for anything. You didn't know where he stood because he rarely stated where he stood on issues. He seemed to have no moral compass. While president, he would often cheat on his wife, and he had parties in the White House where they would illegally gamble and smuggle in alcohol at the height of prohibition. He didn't ever get much work done. He preferred socializing and partying to working. When he actually did work, he signed crappy laws. One law he actually did sign was the Emergency Quota Act, which was really a law designed to favor Western and Northern European immigrants and limit immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe, as well as most of the rest of the world. To sum it up, while Harding was a nice guy who was easy to get along with, he surrounded himself with shady characters and avoided any action whatsoever while in office. He was just a horrible president. And if you haven't noticed by this point, character means a lot to me in terms of how I view a president. There are, of course, exceptions, like Harding, who I just mentioned, and George W. Bush. I love you, man, but you just made some really bad decisions while in office. Well, that will do it. Those are my 10 least favorite presidents. Let me know in the comments below who you think was the worst president in American history. I'm sure you'll agree with some of them. You might be surprised by others, though. A shout-out to Buck Russell, my newest Patreon supporter. Thank you so much for your support. And also another shout-out to my friend Professor Dave of Professor Dave Explains. He has a whole playlist of biography videos about all the presidents, and John Tyler should be up soon, so look below for the link for that. Thank you so much for watching.
Well, that should give you a pretty good understanding of a lot about the different presidents that we've had that were useless, worthless. And that's one reason why I said, if you listen very carefully, you would have seen a lot of the attributes expressed about those particular presidents that are similar to the attributes that are being expressed and displayed by the one that we presently have in office. As you can see, our present president has exercised some of the same characteristics as those who are considered the worst. And he is one of them, and I'm quite sure will replace those particular individuals too. While I'm going through the process of trying to find what I wanted to do next, I'm going to see if I can find the person that I
need to show you the five foods you must
excuse the sound, please. All right, there you go. All right, now we're going to move on to another particular segment, which is called "What Happened to." Well, I don't know if I'll do that. That was about the sections dealing with the Confederate President Jefferson Davis. I don't think I'll do that one particularly because that doesn't make a lot of sense. We all know that he should have been put into I don't know. Let's go on and listen to The information concerning
on the history of I have a degree in history.
Yeah, well, that's a little too loud. Let me see if I can turn that down for you. But what we're going to be listening to, let me give you some background. This is a history about one of Abraham Lincoln's children, his father, and Abraham Lincoln had a son, actually, that was in the Army. And and the reason why I'm going on to this particular segment is because Lincoln was Republican. And as a Republican, he did much to slavery had concluded in a lot of places before even Lincoln did it. It was more in the northern parts of the United States that slavery had already concluded. But in the southern states, that had not occurred. So Lincoln, one of the fathers of actually the Republican Party, went through a major change. But I'm not interested in that right now. I'm interested in talking to you about the history of one of his children. Let's take a listen.
And I love history. And if you love history, too, this is what you do for you.
On April 9, 1865, General Robert E. Lee surrendered the Army of Northern Virginia to Union General Ulysses S. Grant following the defeat of the Confederate Army at the Battle of Appomattox Courthouse. The surrender documents were actually signed in the parlor of a home owned by a man named William McLean, and they were witnessed by both Grant and Lee's staff. The last survivor among those witnesses lived all the way until 1926, and by coincidence was a very famous person, one of the most important statesmen of his day. This is him later in life. Don't recognize him? Maybe you recognize his dad. Robert Todd Lincoln was Abraham Lincoln's firstborn son and the only one of Abraham Lincoln's children to survive to adulthood. His younger brother Edward died of a fever at just the age of 3. Robert grew up at a time when his father was practicing law on a circuit and thus was traveling, gone most of the time, and so their relationship was distant, not very close. Robert once noted that his most vivid memories of his father growing up was Abraham packing his saddlebags. By the time that Robert's father was elected president, Robert was attending Harvard University. He described his father as being so busy that they scarcely had 10 minutes quiet time together during his entire presidency. Robert graduated Harvard in 1864 and briefly attended law school there, but he felt compelled to join the Union Army and share the risk that everybody else was taking. At first, his mother resisted. His little brother, Willie, had died in the White House of a fever in 1862, and his mother, Mary Todd Lincoln, feared that she could not withstand another loss. But Robert eventually prevailed, and his father asked General Grant if Robert could be assigned to his staff. Robert was made an assistant adjutant and given the rank of captain, and that is why he was present to witness Lee's surrender. Robert had traveled to Washington to visit his parents on April 15th, and his parents invited him to go to the theater with them, but he declined. He had been traveling on horseback all day and needed a rest. And so Robert narrowly missed his father's assassination. Robert moved with his mother and his younger brother, Tad, to Chicago, and he continued his law studies. He was admitted to the bar in 1867. In 1868, he married the daughter of a United States senator. They had 3 children. In 1876, Robert was elected town supervisor of the town of South Chicago, a town that was eventually absorbed into the city of Chicago. That was his only elected office of his career. In 1877, he was offered the position of Assistant Secretary of State by President Rutherford B. Hayes, but he declined, although he remained active in Republican politics. And then in 1881, he accepted a cabinet appointment as Secretary of War in the new cabinet of President James Garfield. He was with Garfield in the train station in July of 1881 and witnessed Garfield's assassination. Robert continued to serve as Secretary of War in the cabinet of President Chester A. Arthur, where he was involved in many military reforms. He left the position in 1885. And then in 1889, he was appointed to the important position of Minister to the United Kingdom under President Benjamin Harrison, where he served for 4 years. When he returned to the United States, he became General Counsel of the Pullman Palace Car Company, the world-famous maker of railway cars. And when the founder, George Pullman, died in 1897, Robert was made president of the Pullman Car Company. He served in this position until 1911 when he left due to ill health, but he stayed on as chairman of the board clear until 1922. Despite his very accomplished life, Robert Todd Lincoln is often remembered for three things. The first was a coincidence. Somewhere in 1863 or 1864, Robert Todd Lincoln was riding a train from New York City to Washington, D.C., and while in Jersey City, New Jersey, he was bumped off a train platform, landing in the dangerous spot between the platform and the train. A stranger reached down and pulled him out, and when Robert looked up, he realized that his savior was the most famous actor of the day, a man named Edwin Booth. Only later did Edwin Booth find out that the young man that he had saved was President Lincoln's son, and that is said to have offered Edwin Booth some solace, as he was personally devastated when his younger brother, John Wilkes Booth, murdered President Lincoln. Second, in 1875, Robert had his mother, Mary Todd Lincoln, committed to an asylum. He was concerned about erratic behavior after the death of his younger brother, Ted, at the age of 18. Mary was able to get some letters out to her attorney, who was able to convince Robert to let her leave the asylum and live with her sister, but it included some public embarrassment for Robert, and he and his mother never fully reconciled. And finally, Robert Todd Lincoln is sometimes described as being somewhat unlucky because of his proximity to three presidential assassinations. He just missed his father's assassination, he was there when James A. Garfield was assassinated, and he was just getting off a train going to visit President William McKinley when McKinley was shot in 1901. It is tragic that a man who lived such an accomplished life is remembered for coincidences. He was there for three presidential assassinations because he was proximate to power during a tumultuous time. But Robert Todd Lincoln lived an extraordinary life. He was born poor and yet found great success and died very wealthy. He was an elder statesman. He was a leader in his party who was suggested as a candidate for president or vice president many times but always declined. He was the president of one of the largest corporations in the country. He was, frankly, one of the most accomplished men of his era. His last public appearance was May 30th of 1922, when he appeared with President Warren G. Harding and former President and Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, William Howard Taft, at the dedication of the Lincoln Memorial. He passed away in 1926, just a few days shy of his 83rd birthday. He was the last surviving member of the Garfield and Arthur administrations and the last surviving witness to Lee's surrender. Robert Todd Lincoln lived an amazing, extraordinary, accomplished life during one of the most dynamic periods in American history. And darn it, he deserves to be remembered as more than just his father's son. I'm the History Guy. I hope you enjoyed this edition of my series, 5 Minutes of History, Forgotten History,
I have to cut that off because the music is despicable. In any event, it should give you an idea that there, each of these presidents of the United States had children, or some did, some didn't. Well, in fact, there was one president that was not even married when he took office. But it's very enlightening to hear that Abraham Lincoln, his child, see, one of the things that this particular presentation did not indicate is that Abraham Lincoln's son, Todd, did not have the they say he was a captain when he went with Garfield for the signing of Appomattox. But he later on became a colonel and stayed in the service long enough to become a colonel. And so he from what I understand and from things that I've read about him, was really a very intelligent person. It was just that because of his association with a lot of people on a political level, had to endure the death of a number of presidents. So what we're going to do is we're going to go on and we're going to listen to some stories that are talked to you, that are brought to my attention, about soldiers that revealed what they saw. That's why it's so horrible for there to be war. Let's give a listen.
Well, I've been thinking a lot about my grandparents lately. If they were on their last dollar, they'd give you 50 cents. And the tenfold plate to take home. We could use a lot more of that these days. If elected, every day I serve South Carolina in the Senate, the spirit of my grandparents would be serving the Lord with me.
Well, when I got to Vietnam, I literally expected to be welcomed with open arms by the people of Vietnam. I had in my head the black and white newsreels I had seen on the Walter Cronkite 20th Century show of the American troops rolling through villages in France and being showered with wine and flowers and kisses. And as we were driving down, a guy from the battalion I was assigned to picked me up in a Jeep at Da Nang, and we had to drive the 20 miles to where my battalion was located. And I really was disappointed that there were people standing along the road waving to me and, you know, offering me flowers and things. I really expected to be greeted as with open arms as a liberator, and it was as though I was invisible, as though I didn't exist. And that was a little perplexing. Moreover, they looked funny. And they acted funny. And just riding along in this Jeep the first day I got there. They lived in these straw huts, and they had animals in their backyards, and they weren't like us. They smelled bad. The whole country smelled bad. You could smell it. It hurt the nose. And that was disturbing. When I was there for about, on the third day I was there, this guy who had picked me up in the Jeep, a corporal who I was ultimately going to replace, he and I were in the battalion intelligence section. We were sent down to the tractor park, the amphibious tractor park, to meet a bunch of detainees. It was our responsibility to take care of prisoners, and detainees were a classification of civilians. They were not combatants. They could be detained for questioning. That's why they were called detainees. And Jimmy and I went down there to the track park, and two tractors came in. They had a whole bunch of Vietnamese up on top. High, flat-topped vehicles, about 8 or 9 feet tall. And as the tracks wheeled into the park, the Marines up on top immediately began hurling these people off. They were bound hand and foot, so that they had no way of breaking their falls. And they were old men, women, children, no young men. And I couldn't believe these guys were treating these people this way. I turned to Jimmy and said, I grabbed him by the arm and said, what are those guys doing? We're supposed to be helping these people. And Jimmy turned to me and he looked at my hands on his arm, took them off, and he said, "Aaron, you better keep your mouth shut until you know what's going on around here." And I think it was at that point that I realized things were not quite what I was expecting. It went downhill from there. And again, I can't even begin to explain the space of time that you have, all of the things that went into it, but I began to understand that it became obvious that the enemy was the very people in these villages around us. We were in a very heavily populated area at that time. They were the enemy, or at least the enemy was out there somewhere, and we couldn't tell one from another. And day after day, our patrols went out, and we ran into snipers and mines, and snipers and mines, and snipers and mines. I saw 4 armed enemy soldiers the first 8 months I was in Vietnam. And yet our battalion, during that same period of time, sustained 75 mining and sniping incidents per month, over half of them resulting in casualties. This is for a unit of about 1,000 men. But there was no one to fight back at. And you begin to think, these people are the enemy. They're all the enemy. And then you go through villages and, you know, you get sniped at, and so you call an airstrike in on the village, and the whole village goes up. Or you go through a place and you search it, and you burn houses and blow them up. The common perception, the notion I had when I was in high school was that the Viet Cong terrorized the Vietnamese population, forced them to fight against the Americans on the pain of death. What I began to understand in Vietnam was that they didn't need to do things like that. All they had to do was let a Marine patrol go through a village. And whatever was left of that village, they had all the recruits that they needed. I began to understand why the Vietnamese didn't greet me with open arms, why they, in fact, hated me. But, of course, that didn't change the fact that, my friends were getting killed and injured every day, and the only place that you could focus your own anger and fear was on those civilians who were there. So it was this self-perpetuating mechanism. The longer that we stayed in Vietnam, the more Viet Cong there were, because we created them, we produced them. None of that distilled itself into the clear kind of expression that I'm presenting now. What I began to understand within days, and which became patently clear within months, was that what was going on here was not what I'd been told. What was going on here was nuts. And I wanted to get out. I knew if I was still alive on March the 5th, 1968, they'd stick me on an airplane in Da Nang. We used to call it the Freedom Bird. And I could fly away and forget the whole thing. Turned out not to be quite so easy to forget it, but that was the notion. And so it was my last 8-9 months in Vietnam. I ceased to think. I quite literally ceased to think about why I was there or what I was doing. The sole purpose for my being in Vietnam at that point was to stay alive until I could get out.
I wish I had better news, but another major news outlet just labeled my critical Montana Senate race a toss-up. I'm starting to get worried. We're down in the polls, and President Trump and Mitch McConnell.
And the reason for that is that the kinds of questions that began to present themselves were just the questions themselves were ugly. And I didn't want to know the answers. It's like banging on a door. You knock on a door, and the door opens slightly, and behind that door it's dark, and there's loud noises coming like there's wild animals in there or something. And you peer into the darkness, and you can't see what's there, but you can hear all this ugly stuff. You want to step into that room? No way. You just sort of back out quietly, pull the door shut behind you, and walk away from it. And that's what was going on. The questions themselves were too ugly to even ask, let alone try to deal with the answers. Now, part of what was going on is that I could not have made sense of what I was seeing and doing in Vietnam because I did not have a full deck of cards.
The reason why I play this is because it's very interesting that people, when we talk about wars, we talk about the First World War, the Second World War, the Korean War. People who came home from the Vietnam War were treated very poorly when they came home. And people who went there with a different impression of why they were being sent there. That is one of the reasons why Muhammad Ali did not want to go there to start off with. And many of the wars or conflicts that they're called that occurred after that are somewhat meaningless because of the kind of ideas that were projected to make sure people said they were going to protect this country. The last thing that I wanted to do was to give you a presentation about a Buffalo Soldier. I don't know if many of you know about a Buffalo Soldier, but let's find out what is the scheduling segment of this part dealing with a Buffalo Soldier.
My full name is Nolan Seth. I was born the first day of September, 1918. My dad was Brack Seth. That's all I ever knew dad was, Brack. My mama was named Joanna. We were raised to work. My daddy was a farmer in Leesville. And he believed in working, and he was a hard worker. Wherever Dad was, that's where I was. In fact, he always called me Sweet Boy Lenina. Now, what that means, I don't know. But my dad, I was created by my dad, and he was created by his baby boy. He was a real man. He, when he was a young man, he drank that whiskey and ride his horse and go through the town and shoot the town up. My family had 5 boys and 6 girls, 11 of us. Well, Mom had to do most of the raising, and she made it through when I was going. But she, we were so poor. My dad left us early. I remember coming home one day, and I came in through the back door. Mama was, this touches me. I came in through the back door. Mama was out on the front porch in the swing. She heard me. And she said, "No, there's some biscuits in the oven." I picked the last of the collard greens. They are sitting on the stove. But I didn't have no stuff to put in them, Nolan. So I cooked them with lard. That tore me up. I quit school, and she didn't have to tell me to quit. I quit. Roosevelt had started the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps. The CCC was a forerunner of the United States Army. Roosevelt was a far-seeing man. He knew that Hitler was raising sand at that time, and we were going to have to tangle with him. And so he started with CCC. There was no bridges, no roads, and no trees. The soil was eroded. Roosevelt fixed all that. He told us that he wanted every man to work because there was no work. Everybody was a hobo. Trains was running with full of men going from state to state. Roosevelt said, "I'm going to stop this. I'm going to start the CCC and put everybody to work." But he told you when he hired you, he said, "I'm going to pay you $1 a day, and a month to me only has 30 days. You get $30 at the end of the month. But you can only keep $5 of them. The $25 is going on to Mom and Dad. I'm going to see to that. Me and Dad do that." At the same time, Roosevelt was building barracks and camps because he knew we were going to need them later on. I stayed in the CCC for 2 terms. So I stayed the 2 years that I was allotted, and I had to go back home to Pine Bluff, Arkansas. They sent me back home, and my mama and my 2 sisters, they were the only ones there, needed me, and I could see what condition they were living in. I went back down to the CCC headquarters and begged the lady to let me go back for one more term. I overpowered her. She let me go back in for another 2 years for the sake of my sisters and my mama. She agreed with me because I begged her on my knees. When I came out of the CCC, it was 1940. So I was old enough then to fight, to be a soldier. Well, I never thought about the United States Army. I hadn't even thought of that, really. But the Buffalo Soldiers was, they got a tremendous history. My mother had a letter, and she said, "Nola, you have a letter from the president." When I opened the letter, he told me, he said, "I want you, Nola, himself, to be one of my soldiers." He greeted me, of course, the letter did. But he told me, "I want you to take a physical." And he told me where to have to go to get the physical. "And if you pass the physical, I want you to report to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and become a member of the 10th Cavalry and be one of my soldiers." And when I told my mom, she started crying and said, "Oh, no, they can't. What do you mean going to the army? I said, Mama, don't cry. I said, it's a good thing for you and the girls. I said, Mama, you're going to get a check if I pass the pivotal. She don't understand that. I'm going to take my baby boy. No, no, no. Now, a lot of the guys were taking balls of soap and making a peel out of it and swallowing it and drank a lot of water to make the blood pressure go up. They don't want to go into the army. I told them, I said, I don't want nothing to do with that. I don't want to pass this physical. I passed, and then Roosevelt got the word that I had passed. He not only took me, he took 400 blacks out of Pine Bluff, Arkansas, on the Missouri Pacific train and took us all the way to Fort Leavenworth, Canada. I'd never been away from home in my life. Pine Bluff is a pretty good place to live. We never had any troubles there. Never. And so we went into the army for Fort Leavenworth. Fort Leavenworth, ain't nobody going to ask your family that good sense. The officers were kind. And what happened is, you just didn't be, you don't become not an officer in the 10th Cavalry or the 9th Cavalry. I had a good time when I was in the service. The best thing I can remember is he'd like I wanted to. I was a youngster then, what they call a private, book private. But the army was a little salvation to me and my family. I was glad to be a soldier. I loved horses. In the army, I had two horses, in fact, in the service. And when you're in a horse cavalry, they assign you two horses. You have a spare because, you know, one might break a leg or it might get sick or anything could happen. So they have sick call every morning, 10 o'clock. It's just like they did for us soldiers. I had a horse named Funston. I had a beautiful bill. He was wide. And that's the kind of horse I need because at that time I'm learning. I don't know a whole lot about him. And he was a good horse to ride with him. He was one when they say gallop, then all you got to do is sit in the saddle. Because he's going to give you that ride, you know. Anyway, but he ran away with me though one day. We were out riding for pleasure, learned how to, the different things you need to know when you're riding a horse. How to act properly, handle him. And they teach you, if he gets spooked, which he will get a lot of time, and he's going to start running then. They said, never jump from that horse, but take up your reins and cut him in a circle, because he can't stand that cut on his mouth. Well, he got to running, he got spooked and took off. And I was riding along the Kansas River. We were riding that morning, a whole bunch of us. And the sergeant in charge, he way up in front. He didn't know the horse had done broke out of the ranks and started running away with me. And he headed right for the river. And I can't swim. They teach you never jump from a horse when he gets spooked and starts, you know, running. Because if your foot should happen to get caught in that stirrup, he'd drag you to death. He was going with me. And I said, well, Lord, I can't swim. And you had your people to say, don't jump. But I'm jumping. To this day, if I had it all to do over, instead of buying a home, I'd buy me a farm where I could have me a horse at least. Because I love to ride. And at 96, people tell me you can't ride anymore, but I believe I can. I met the other thing, not running with him. But not just me. Every black that was in the unit could run, ran with him for one morning. They just built the conditioning camp at Fort Riley because the government moved the 10th Cavalry to Fort Riley, Kansas, where the 9th Cavalry was at already, so the two units could train together, both black units. So it was a joy to run with Joe. Joe didn't do no work naturally. just being Joe Louis. He was a fine man, though. He was a gentleman, perfect gentleman. In fact, he was living in Junction City, he and Marvel, and he knew that the soldiers didn't have nothing for them to do. So what he did was he contacted Channel Station to come here with his big, pretty good band, and I'm going to be responsible for all the young ladies, so the soldiers will have someone to dance with. And I'll have Nathan to play the music, and he could do that. Somebody got the young ladies together. You paid for the bill. He paid for the buses. And all the girls, Joe brought them in by the busload. Well, Wilma came to this day at the Joe's sponsor in Topeka, Kansas. But a friend of hers, I had met her. And I thought we were going to be with her. But she had another fellow. She was going to be with. And Wilma said she asked her if she would entertain me. So then I thought it was my kids could have ever seen. He was so handsome. And he seemed so good. Great manners. And I never just thought that was the best thing that ever happened to have a kid. Because he was from the South. And it was a little bit different than the northern boys were.
And I found out when we got on the dance floor, he knew what to do. And Joe Lewis even played the drums that night. Well, you know Joe can't play no drums, but that's Joe Lewis. The girls just went crazy over Joe Lewis. Anyway, for me and Wilma, we hit the dance floor. And I found out that she was all right. And so we began to talk and hold hands. We even sat outside on the front steps and talked a long time. I knew right then, I said, that's the girl that I want. I had to go back to camp the next day, and they had to go home naturally that night.
Not long after that, he was transferred to Mississippi. And I thought, well, that's the end of that. But then we started writing, and you know, things progressed.
I remember, Normandy. You'll never forget that. Eisenhower was walking with a big old bullhorn, greeting the soldiers and telling us, brother, what a fine thing we were doing for our country. And a whole lot of other things he was telling us. And I remember these words. To me, they were very touching, and I know they must have been touching to others also. He said, you guys have done a great thing. This is your country, which is true. You're doing this for your country. But I want you to know that some of you are going to go in, and then some of you won't come back. When they loaded us up on the LST to go into the shore, there were so many young men floating.
At that time, we ain't got the shore yet.
Rifles were floating. Packs were floating. They were dead already. Couldn't swim. I couldn't swim. And a lot of it, I imagine, was in the shape I was in, because we didn't have time to be talking then. But God Almighty had something in store for me. I don't know how I got ashore, but I got ashore.
All right, back in. I remember D-Day. I remember today there was a train, and he's going to say the desert thing. As I look back on the bus, I stopped off to sleep. And just as I'm talking to you, I heard his voice calling my name. I woke up, of course, kind of frightened me. When I got home, the radio said it was D-Day had started. And I just
So I just was terrified because I knew he was in your neighborhood. That was, you know, you didn't get these letters that often. And of course, they were all senseless, so which is, there wasn't anything in the library that was going on. But, yes, that was the worst time for me.
So I went in as everybody does, go to the book crowd. But I knew my background. I knew I wasn't the smart boy. I knew I was a poor boy. I knew I was a black boy. But I thought things would be different when I came back, because I fought in five campaigns. I fought in the ordinaries. And I fought in Central Europe. I also went over to Southern Wales. I didn't have to fight, but I went over there to fight. I came out naturally when the war was over. And I had some good things happen to me.
I was able somehow to become the first son. Now, the first song is The Highest Rank,
a black all-white who is an enlisted man, could reach in that day. I served for over 20 years. And when I got out, I didn't know what I was going to do, because they don't need no first sergeant out here. They need them in Army, Navy, Marines. And I told my wife, I said, honey, I don't know what I'm going to do. I got this big family, and I ain't no first sergeant anymore. There was very little work you could do. Nobody would hire you, wanted to hire you, rather, as a rule. I was lucky enough to get a job with my city on the tail end of the garbage truck. So I told my wife, I said, honey, I'm working. I got a job. But I don't want to work on the back end of the drug garbage truck. I'm going to quit it. That girl told me, don't quit it. The Lord has something for you. That's the word she used. I could tell it to work. But I sure didn't like it. I wanted to quit. So what would you do, honey? You got a big family was growing. She said, I don't know. Excuse me. She said, the Lord has something for you. So I took the job. And I worked for about 2 months on the back end of the truck, picking up people's garbage and emptying it. One day I went to work, as usual, and all the trucks have radios in them so the headquarters can talk to truck drivers. The radio came on, the abnormal himself reported to the Daily Union newspaper office. And he drove me and he said, no, what do you do? I said, I ain't done nothing. What do you want me for? And I walked in and see the man. He said, no, this is so and so and so and so. On his shoulder. So we had you come up here, Norman, because we have decided that you are the new superintendent of the sanitation department for this city.
Al, you had an opportunity to hear a story about Nolan Self, a young man who did everything he can for his family, and then came back home after the war and spending 20 years in service as a first sergeant understood what exactly what life was all about after. We were sacrificing most of his life to make it possible for his children to be able to go to school and take care of his family. But it was something that he had to experience. Most of us who are African American had to do that and have done that. So today you've had an opportunity to hear three different presentations. And on Friday I'll have three more. This has been Getting It Done, and I have been your host, Dr. Walter Dean.